This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعد. Today, inshallah, we're going to deal with a very interesting person, a very interesting personality. This is one of the tabi'een. So I broke the pattern. We spoke about three imams so far. Everyone is expecting us to talk about Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, right? I was going to talk about him. I'll be honest. I was going to talk about Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. And I love to talk about this man a lot. But because I have to leave by 9, I have a long drive ahead of me. So I have to, by 9, I have to leave here. So to talk about Imam Ahmad in 40 minutes would do him injustice, a big injustice. So I said, no, Imam Ahmad, we have to talk about him for 2 hours at least. For 2 hours. So I'm going to keep it, inshallah, for another day. Now, since the time is going to change, next week the halaqah will be still after Isha. Isha will be at 8, halaqah will be after Isha. But the week after, that means in 2 weeks from now, the halaqah will be after Maghrib. Will be after Maghrib. Because I think Maghrib around that time would be 7:30. So it's good to pray Maghrib. And then start our halaqah. So the halaqah will be between Maghrib and Isha, insha'Allah ta'ala. So the tabi'i that we are dealing with today is a very interesting figure. Really very interesting person. One of the most knowledgeable, but not known very much. His name is common, but people don't know much about him. And there is something that stands out as you study his life, that he hated, or he really struggled a lot with what Arabs call ثقيل الظل or ثقلاء الظل or الرجل الثقيل. ثقيل الظل or الرجل الثقيل in Arabic means someone who is, like, literally speaking, heavy-blooded. What does that mean? Their presence is so heavy. These people are so dumb. They ask very, like, stupid questions. They ask about the obvious. Okay, so they give you hard time. When they are present, they give you hard time, like you don't want to be in their presence. So that's ثقيل الظل. ثقيل الظل. In Egypt, what do you call them? ثقيل, huh? ثقيل دم. Yeah, like heavy-blooded, right? Like his blood is so thick. Okay. So this imam really had like a very special dislike to these kind of people, but he struggled with them a lot. And we will see. Like, he developed a way to answer these people's questions. So we're dealing today with the tabi'i al-jaleel, Amir al-Sha'bi. Amir al-Sha'bi. Amir ibn Shurahil al-Sha'bi. It's good actually to present these figures in our history, because although his name might be common, but we don't know much about him. Most of us don't know much about Amir bin Shurahil al-Sha'bi. And it's good, if you don't know about him, that you get to know about these tabi'een, about their merits and about the good traits and the good practices that they had, because there is a lot to learn from their lives and from their experience. So Amir ibn Shurahil al-Sha'bi, and his kunya is Abu Amr. Abu Amr al-Kufi. He's from Kufa. So his kunya is Abu Amr al-Kufi. Abu Amr al-Kufi. Rahimahullahu ta'ala. He was actually one of the most prolific muhaddithin, scholars of hadith and fiqh. So he narrated a hadith from 50 companions. So among the companions, he has 50 teachers from whom he narrated a hadith. Among them is Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Abbas, some of the greatest companions. So he learned from from Abu Hurairah as well. He narrated from Abu Hurairah. So he narrated from the prominent scholars among the companions of the Prophet ﷺ. A very special thing about Amr ibn Shurahil, during his lifetime, he was born, by the way, during the Khilafah of Umar ibn al-Khattab. He was born almost six years after Umar ibn al-Khattab became Khalifa. That makes it what year? What year did Umar al-Khattab become the Khalifa? What year? The Prophet ﷺ passed away the year 11 after Hijrah. The year 11 after Hijrah, the Prophet ﷺ passed away. Then the Khalifa became who? Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. How long did the Khilafah of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu last for? Almost two years. So what year Umar ibn al-Khattab became the Khalifa? 13. Year 13 after Hijrah. How long did the Khilafah of Umar al-Khattab last for? These are quizzes, yeah? Questions. 10 years, excellent. 10 years. Umar al-Khattab was the Khalifa from year 13 to year 23. Who became the Khalifa after Umar al-Khattab? Uthman ibn Affan. How long did he live to stay and be Khalifa? For how long? 10? No. 4? No. Not even close. Not really 8. Let's work it out. Let's work so you don't forget it. You don't forget it. So we're talking about year 23 when Umar al-Khattab was martyred, was killed by Abu Lu'lu al-Majusi. Okay? That's the time Umar al-Khattab was killed. 23 after Hijrah. Now, the Khulafa, four rightly, Al-Khulafa al-Rashidun, the four rightly guided caliphs. The last of their reign, of their caliphate, which is the death of Ali ibn Abi Talib, was the year 40. This is why the 40, 40. This is why the Prophet ﷺ says, تكون الخلافة الراشدة بعد... Anyway, the hadith is not going through my mind now. So, the Khilafah of Ali ibn Abi Talib ended 40. That's the end of the Khilafah al-Rashida. 40. So, Umar ibn Khattab, Ali ibn Abi Talib, was Khalifa for 5 years. 5 years, Ali ibn Abi Talib. So, then this makes the Khilafah of Uthman how long? 12 years. 12 years. Okay, you guys are good at mathematics. From 23 to 35 was the Khilafah of Uthman radiyallahu anhu, then Ali ibn Abi Talib for 5 years. So, Al-Sha'bi was born around the year, what, 19. Around year 19. He was born in Al-Kufa. He was born in Al-Kufa. His father was an Arab, but his mother was from As-Sabi. His mother was a concubine. But obviously, in Islam, when a concubine, slave of war, right? So she comes from a Persian origin. She's Persian. She was one of the concubines. When the Muslims obviously took over Iraq and what's known today was Khurasan, Mawara al-Nahr, what's known as Iran today, and all these areas. So the people who fought against the Muslims, okay, the captives there, the women, were taken as concubines, as happens everywhere. So, but in Islam, when a concubine becomes a mother, she is freed. She's freed, she becomes free, she becomes a mother, becomes a wife. So his mother, his mother comes from As-Sabi. From As-Sabi. So his mother is Persian. Okay, so Amr ibn Shrahil al-Sha'bi, very interesting personality, and amongst the most learned. The very interesting thing about him is, even in the presence, in his life, there was a lot of companions. A lot of companions. Yet, even in the presence of companions, people used to come to Amr for fatwa. Even in the life of the companions. فَكَانَ يُسْتَفْتَى وَالصَّحَابَةُ مُتَكَاثِرُونَ مُتَوَافِرُونَ So when there are so many companions around, still the fatwa used to come back to Amr ibn Shurahil al-Sha'bi. This is how learned, how educated and well-versed in knowledge he was. That's Amr ibn Shurahil. We will see why he occupied such a high position in knowledge. Something very interesting about him that shows his how bright this man was, how knowledgeable he was. He was very close to the Khulafa. So mainly, when he became prominent, he became well known. That was the Khilafah al-Umayyah, the Umayyad Caliphate. So specifically, the Khilafah of Abdul Malik bin Marwan. He was very close with Abdul Malik bin Marwan, and he wasn't away from the palace. So this scholar, this tabi'i, this muhaddith, was not away from the palace. He was connected to the government. He was close to the government. So he was very close, to the extent that Abdul Malik bin Marwan sent him as a messenger, as a deputy, as an ambassador to the Byzantine emperor. He sent him to what was called Al-Astana, Istanbul, where the Byzantine Empire capital was there. So he sent him to the emperor of the Byzantines as an ambassador to speak with him and negotiate about certain things. So when he went and he met the emperor, they had a discussion and they spoke. And the emperor was impressed with Amr ibn Shurahil al-Sha'bi. Very impressed with his intelligence, his sharpness, his present mind, his ability to respond, his vast knowledge, his intelligence, everything. He admired that guy. Then after, you know, they had these discussions and probably some kind of agreements, usually there would be, the emperor would write to the caliph a letter, and it would be obviously sealed, so the messenger doesn't see it. So the letter was handed, or the files were handed to Amr al-Sha'bi, and in order to carry it, take it back to Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan, the Umayyad caliph. So when Amr arrived back in Damascus, and he handed over the kitab, or the letter, from the emperor to the caliph, he read it. So there were so many things in it. And then the caliph read something there. When he finished, when he was done, he turns to Amr and he says, do you know what this emperor wanted? What he had, what he intended? Amr says, no. Obviously he didn't look into it. He's not supposed to look into the letter. And it was sealed. He said, he wanted me to kill you. He wanted me to kill you. Guess how? The emperor wrote in the letter to the caliph. He said, I am puzzled and amazed how a people who have a person like your ambassador and they don't make him their king. I'm amazed. I'm puzzled. How there are people in their right minds who have a person so intelligent and so exceptional like this messenger and they don't make him their leader. So the caliph understood. He said, he wanted me to kill you. So this is how impressive Imam al-Sha'bi was. And we will see how his good presentation and how his good character and his diplomatic skills are actually going to save his life. Just like with Imam al-Shafi'i, will save his life. So, let's take a physical description of Imam al-Shafi'i. Imam al-Shafi'i was very thin, very skinny. Thin and skinny. He was little. Physically, he wasn't a big figure. So that's Imam al-Shafi'i. His beard, towards obviously, past the middle of his life, his beard was mainly, he would use henna to dye it. So it was red. Most of the time it was that orangey, you know, color which comes with the henna. And he was a person with a very good sense of humor. He had a very strong sense of humor. And we will see with his fatawa. And that was his strategy to deal with thick-blooded people. That was his strategy. Imam al-Zuhri, the famous scholar, he says, قال الإمام الزهري العلماء أربعة العلماء أربعة سعيد بن المسيب في المدينة وعامر الشعبي في الكوفة والحسن البصري في البصرة ومكحول في الشام. He says the scholars of our time are four. This is Imam al-Zuhri. Imam al-Zuhri says something like this. That's one of the imams of al-Tabi'in. He says the scholars of our time are four. He says in Medina سعيد بن المسيب سعيد ابن المسيب. In Kufa, Amr al-Sha'bi, the person we're talking about today. In al-Basra, al-Hasan al-Basri. And in al-Sham, Makhul, Makhul al-Shami. There's also another statement from Abu Usama, it's one of the Tabi'in as well. He says, Kana Umar ibn al-Khattab fi zamanihi ra's al-Nas. During his time, Umar ibn al-Khattab was the master of people. He was the head of all people in terms of knowledge, in terms of influence. Umar ibn al-Khattab was the number one. وَكَانَ بَعْدَهُ إِبْنُ عَبَّاسٍ. So when Umar ibn al-Khattab passed away, the main person specifically for knowledge, the main reference was ابن عباس رضي الله عنه. وكان بعده الشعبي. And after Ibn Abbas, when Ibn Abbas passed away, the reference for knowledge in the Muslim Ummah became Amir al-Sha'bi. Amir al-Sha'bi. So you can see we're talking about a very weighty figure, a very important figure in our history. And it's a pity that we don't know much about him. We don't know much about him. He's one of the main scholars among the Tabi'een. وَكَانَ بَعْدَهُ سُفْيَانِ الثَّوْرِ. After Amr al-Sha'bi, the authority in terms of knowledge was handed down to Sufyan al-Thawri rahimahullah ta'ala. عن أبي بكر الهذلي قال قال لي محمد بن سيرين يا أبا بكر إذا دخلت الكوفة فاستكثر من حديث الشعبي فإنه كان ليسأل وأصحاب النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم أحياء. So this is two from among the Tabi'een. Muhammad ibn Sirin, famous Tabi'i, the one who was exceptional in interpretations of the dreams. Muhammad ibn Sirin. But he wasn't only in dreams, he was a scholar. Muhammad ibn Sirin was a scholar, rahimahullah. So he says to one of his prominent students, Abu Bakr al-Hudali, he says to him, if you go to Kufa, then get as much as possible from get as much hadith as possible from Amr al-Sha'bi. Learn as much hadith as possible from him. Why? Because he used to give fatwa and he used to teach, and people used to ask him, even when the companions of the Prophet ﷺ were present. This is how prominent and strong in knowledge he was. So Amr al-Sha'bi, as we said, was a very quick person, very sharp, and he had a strong sense of humor. But he was extremely intelligent. He says, listen to his intelligence and why he became so excellent in knowledge. He says, مَا كَتَبْتُ سَوْدَاءَ فِي بَيْضَاءَ إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ هَذَا وَلَا حَدَّثَنِي أَحَدٌ قَطُّ بِحَدِيثٍ إِلَّا حَفِظْتُهُ وَلَا أَحْبَبْتُ أَنْ يُعِيدَهُ عَلَيَّ. He says, never in my life have I written anything. I've never taken notes. I've never taken notes in my life until our present day. And I've never heard any statements or anything from any person except that I memorized it straight away without a need for him to say it again to me, to repeat it. What does that mean? If he heard something, he read something, he registered it, memorized it completely. That's how sharp and strong his memory was. So he read something, you told him a story, you told him about something, about a piece of information, you told him about a hadith, straight away, he would memorize it as it is. This is very powerful memory. And we said previously this was very common among the Arabs. But now obviously with modern lifestyles, a lot of distractions, a lot of commitments here and there, you know, most people lost their memory. Imam al-Shafi'i, we said, was exceptionally good at this as well. Imam Shafi'i, by the way, had something. It was like a ruler. It was like a piece of wood. That when he read something, he would actually, you know, put the ruler under the line in order to cover the rest of the page. Why? Because if his eye catches something, it would memorize it. So his strong memory became more of a burden. And he would sometimes as well, like if he was reading a book, obviously, you know, a book has obviously two sides, right? Like this. So he's flicking through the book, that's how it is. So he would put his piece of wood on that side. Why? Because as he's reading this, he doesn't want his eyes to carry on the other side, so it memorizes or it links this line to the line on the opposite page. That's the kind of memory we're talking about. So Amr al-Sha'bi, rahimahullah, had this kind of memory. He said, I've never taken notes. Once I heard something, I memorized it. It's registered. And this kind of memory, by the way, is very powerful. And we said among the Arabs was very common. So someone would hear some poetry, sometimes 100 lines of poetry. He would hear that poetry for the first time, and that's it. They would memorize it. They would memorize it from the first time, and they would repeat it all together. I know the famous story from one of the caliphs, who actually had the ability to memorize poetry, lines of poetry, as soon as he heard them, from the first time. He would memorize them. They would register. So, So he actually made a challenge to everyone, all the poets around. He said, if any poet comes with a piece of poetry that I don't already know, I'm going to give them a gift. And the gift would be, you know, whatever they've written it on, they bring it, we'll weigh it up against gold, and I will give them the same weight in gold. So poets would be working on beautiful poetry, and they would bring it to him, and they would start saying it, and he could memorize it upon hearing it once. So he, as the poet, as soon as the poet finishes reciting their poetry, they say, the caliph would say, oh, I know this already. And the poet would say, how do you know this? I just wrote it last night. Like, I've just invented it. I made it. So how come you know it? He would say, well, I know it already. I can prove it. And I can recite it to you, all complete. 100 lines, I'd recite it to you now. And he would actually recite it, complete, without any mistake. That wasn't the whole trick. He had a servant who could memorize any poetry at any length upon hearing it twice. So when the poet has recited his poetry, and then the caliph said, I know it already, and then he recites it to prove it, now the servant has memorized it 2 times. So you say, I'm not even the only one who knows it. I have a servant who knows it. Come here, come here. The servant would be hiding somewhere. Come on, bring him, bring him. So he comes. You know this poetry? He says, yeah, I know it. Can you say it to him? And he would recite the whole qasida, right? So the man would be like, out of his mind. Come on, man, I just wrote this. He said, that's not the only thing. I have a girl servant. I have a maid. And she knows it. Why? Because she memorizes any poetry upon hearing it 3 times. And now it's been recited 3 times. She said, go and get that maid. Go and get her. She's actually hiding behind. So they bring her, and she recites the whole same poetry. The guy completely loses his mind. But that's impossible. So until Al-Asma'i, Al-Imam Al-Asma'i, rahimahullah, very intelligent and a master in the Arabic language. Imam Al-Asma'i, Imam Al-Asma'i, by the way, okay, I'll mention that later on, I don't want to mention it now. Imam Al-Asma'i was a Bedouin. And when he came, he dressed up like a Bedouin. Like a Bedouin. And he had locks, hair locks. The Bedouins there, they had hair locks. So his locks would be resting on his shoulders and his chest, coming from underneath his amama. And by the way, this was common among the Arabs even until like 50 years ago. Like even talking about my country, Bedouins, they had jadayil, they had locks. So he came and he actually had written some poetry, and the poetry was very confusing, very confusing. It starts with something like "Sawtu safir al-bulbuli hayyaja qalbi thamali." The whole poem is not such a big one. It's probably 15 lines, but it will blow your mind away because all of it is like "tab tab tabali wal," things like this. A lot of repetition and small syllables and things like that. So it's very confusing. So when the caliph listened to it the first time, he got confused. He couldn't memorize it because Al-Asma'i realized what the trick was. So he said, I'm going to teach him a lesson. So he brought it, the caliph listened to it, he said, he tried, but he couldn't figure it out. Then he thought, maybe the servant could actually figure it out. He checked, no. The maid, no. Now he's stuck. He said, I have to give him, you know, the gold, right? He said, okay, bring the piece of writing. Where is it? Do you have it written? He said, yes. He said, where is it? He said, it's there. I have some camels that are carrying it. He said, what? He said, yeah, because I've been spending some time carving it in stone. So it's a huge piece of marble, yeah? And you need to get like 20 people to come and bring it in. Yeah. Okay, so that's about memory. So Imam al-Shabi was something like this. He would hear something, straight away committed to memory. No questions, from the first time. So he says, one of his statements, مَا سَمِعْتُ مُنْذُ 20 سَنَةً رَجُلًا يحدث بحديث إلا أنا أعلم به منه. Oh, that's a powerful statement. He says, In the last 20 years of my life, in the last 20 years of my life, I've never heard a man relating a hadith from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Talking about a hadith, from a statement from a tradition from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Except that I know this hadith more than he does. So that means no one around him could bring something new to Imam Shaabi. So in the last 20 years, I haven't heard anyone talking about a hadith, or teaching a hadith, or relating a hadith, except that I know it more than that person. وَلَقَدْ نَسِيتُ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ مَا لَوْ حَفِظَهُ رَجُلٌ لَكَانَ بِهِ عَالِمًا. And he said, the knowledge that I have forgotten in my life, if someone were to learn it, he would become a scholar. Shall I repeat it? That's an Arabic expression, by the way. That's an Arabic expression. And the ones who say this, this kind of style, in Sham, we call them Zu'ran or Shabbiha. In Egypt, they call them Baltajiyya. Huh? It's a kind of, like, kind of, they can pick your brain. Basically, they say, you know, what you're going to learn in your life from now on, I've forgotten it already. That's what they're saying, basically, okay? What you are about to learn in the next 50 years in your life, I've forgotten that already. So don't mess with me. That's what it means. So now Imam Shaabi is saying, the knowledge that I have forgotten, because obviously he was speaking at an old age. So the knowledge that I've forgotten in my life, if someone were to learn this knowledge, he would become a scholar. He would become a scholar. That means I have learned so much and I've forgotten so much, and what I know is more than what I've forgotten. Okay, so that's basically what he is saying. One of the tabi'in as well, Abu Mijlaz, he says, مَا رَأَيْتُ فَقِيهًا أَفْقَهَ مِنَ الشَّعْبِيِّ. مَا رَأَيْتُ فَقِيهًا أَفْقَهَ. I haven't seen a person of knowledge, faqih, a scholar of fiqh, who has more understanding or a deeper understanding than Imam al-Sha'bi. Imam al-Sha'bi talks about himself and he says, مَا أَرْوِي شَيْئًا أَقَلَّ مِنَ الشِّعْرِ. He says basically, my weakness is poetry. My weakness is poetry. So I haven't invested much time there in poetry. So that's my weakest point, poetry. مَا أَرْوِي شَيْئًا أَقَلَّ مِنَ الشِّعْرِ وَلَوْ شِئْتُ لَأَنْشَدْتُكُمْ شَهْرًا لَا أُعِيدُ بَيْتًا. He says, the least that I know is poetry. And if I wanted to, I could from now, for 30 days, keep reciting poetry to you, never repeating one line. That's his weakness. You're talking about his weakness. What about his strengths? So you can see Imam al-Sha'bi had a special way, right, of expressing himself. A special way of expressing himself. And that shows a little bit his sense of humor. داود بن أبي هند يقول داود بن أبي هند ما جلست أحدا أعلم من الشعبي another one from التابعين. He says, I haven't sat with a person who has more knowledge than Imam al-Sha'bi. Despite all of this, Imam al-Sha'bi would not venture to give fatwa. People would ask him and he would not answer. And one of the common statements on his tongue was always لا أعلم, I don't know. I don't know. And he's the first one known to have made the statement, because we don't know the originator of the statement, but he's probably the oldest one that's known about, who have said the statement, لَا أَدْرِي نُصْفُ الْعِلْمِ. Saying, I don't know, this is half of knowledge. Because you know your value. And you know what not to say. Because knowledge is not knowing what to say, but knowing what not to say as well. Knowledge is not knowing how to answer and what to answer, but it's also another half of knowledge is knowing what not to answer and when not to answer. So a man asks Ibrahim al-Nakhai, one of the main, the kibar of al-Tabi'een, he asks him about something. Imam al-Nakhai says, I don't know, really I don't know the answer. But they were chatting for a while, then Amr al-Sha'bi passes by. So Ibrahim al-Nakhai says, ask, go and ask that man. It's Amr al-Sha'bi. So the guy chases Amr al-Sha'bi, asks him, and he comes. Then Ibrahim al-Nakhai said, when you ask him, come and inform me about his answer, I want to know. So the guy comes back to Ibrahim al-Nakhai and he says, I asked him and he said he doesn't know. So Ibrahim al-Nakhai, he said, ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْعِلْمِ. He says, that's knowledge. This is knowledge. Now I have my personal assessment of this incident. I think, and by the way, the scholars, you have to read through what the scholars say. Oftentimes the scholars would say to someone, I don't know, because they say they see the person is not able to handle that answer. So they know the true answer might be a fitna for this person. Might be a fitna for this person. And anyone who spends time with the scholars, you will notice this often. And that's taken from the statement of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, radiallahu anhu. ما أنت أحدث الناس بما يعرفون أتريدون أن يكذب الله ورسوله. Similar statement from Ali ibn Abi Talib رضي الله عنه. ما أنت بمحدث قوما حديثا لا تبلغه عقولهم إلا كان لبعضهم فتنة. Says, speak to people something or tell people something they can comprehend. Do you want people to disbelieve in what Allah and His Messenger brought? Or the other statement is, if you tell people something that's above their heads, that's difficult for them to understand and grasp, okay, so they are not at a level to be able to relate to it, then you are causing them fitna. You are putting them in a test, in a trial. So that means not everyone should be answered. Not everyone should be answered. Even if you know the answer. So sometimes the scholars, really they don't know, or maybe they feel they don't have a good assessment of the situation, or they don't have all the details that are relevant, so they would not give a fatwa. Or they find that the person is actually might misuse that fatwa, or might not be mature enough to handle this fatwa, so they would not give it to him. And this is very common among the companions. Abdullah ibn Umar, there are so many like incidents where he actually did something like this. Today, and you don't have to ask, people will start giving you fatwa, shooting fatwa at you, right? And like this happens often as well, someone comes and asks you a question and you're really not comfortable answering the question. You're not comfortable with the answer or you're not sure of the answer. And the person gets frustrated. Why are you an imam then? Who's going to answer my question? SubhanAllah. What if you went to Imam Malik, as we said, remember previously, a man comes to him from Al-Maghrib, from Morocco. From Morocco comes to Imam Malik and he has so many questions, you know, that he's carried from people. And out of 40 questions, Imam Malik answers 4. 36, he says, I don't know. I don't know the answer. So the guy says, I came to you from Morocco. You're telling me I don't know? What should I tell people? He said, just tell them I don't know. It's as simple as that. So the companions, radiallahu anhum, someone would ask for a fatwa. They would say, oh, don't ask me. Ask that person. Ask that person. And they would go around and come back to the same person. And if even, like, that's the problem that with the way we handle knowledge today. We think knowledge is mathematics. No. The scholars have wisdom. They know when to talk, they know when not to talk. They know what to say, they know what not to say. All of this is very important. This is why sometimes there are difficult times you find the scholars say nothing. So when we say, why are the scholars silent? They know what they are doing. If they are scholars, if you believe that they have knowledge, and you want that knowledge from them, at least trust that they have knowledge how to handle this very situation and how to deal with this very question. So if they are silent, they know what they are doing. So leave it for them. Leave it for them and trust. Trust. So knowledge is not taken in that mathematical way. Now, Imam al-Sha'bi, as we said, he was very close to the caliphs and he was very close to al-Hajjaj. Very close to al-Hajjaj, al-Thaqafi. Al-Hajjaj al-Thaqafi used to hold him in high esteem and respect him. And if he walked in, they would give him like the best, you know, spot in that gathering. And everyone, even Al-Hajjaj, would listen to him. But when Ibn al-Ash'ath, you know Ibn al-Ash'ath, one of the Qurra, and he revolted against Al-Hajjaj. He made a revolution against Al-Hajjaj. He had around 100,000 people. 100,000 people. Including like Sa'id ibn Jubayr, one of the Imam of the Tabi'een. So they revolted against Al-Hajjaj. It was a very strong fitna. It was like Al-Hajjaj was almost taken out. But ultimately Al-Hajjaj managed to subdue that revolution. And Imam al-Sha'bi took part in this revolution. He was with Ibn al-Ash'ath. He was with Ibn al-Ash'ath. So after that, Imam al-Sha'bi, you know, was in... He kept hiding for years. He kept a low profile. No one knew who he was. Because al-Hajjaj, he was chasing them one person after the other. He wanted to take them out. But then, al-Hajjaj decided to expand the Muslim, expeditions into Khurasan, into the areas that are known today as Afghanistan, Pakistan, in these areas. So he needed more people. So he made a public, what do you call it, amnesty? Amnesty, is it? Like when you let the criminals say amnesty, right? Yeah. So he gave a public afwun am, public amnesty, right? And he said, the ones who took part in the revolution of Ibn al-Ash'ath, if you guys get involved or conscribe to these expeditions, then we will drop the charges against you. So Imam al-Sha'bi goes and joins the expeditions and he goes and fights with them. But the leader of that army, he recognizes al-Sha'bi and he writes to al-Hajjaj and he says, I've got al-Sha'bi with me. He says, bring him to me. Bring him to me. I need him. So they actually chain him and they send him to al-Hajjaj. So when he goes to al-Hajjaj, that means death. It means death. Oh, well, you revolted against me. He enters, he doesn't say a word. He lets al-Hajjaj speak. He understands. He's a diplomat. He knows how to speak. He's very intelligent. So I'm going to recite or read what al-Hajjaj says and how he replies in Arabic, and I will translate. He says, لَمَّا أُدْخِلْتُ عَلَيْهِ وَرَآنِي قَالَ لَا مَرْحَبًا وَلَا أَهْلًا ثم قال جئتني وليس ولست من الشرف في قومك من بشيء ثم جعلت لك منزلا ومكانا فعرفك الناس ثم خرجت علي. He said, no welcome to you, no welcome. Or as someone else, one of my friends just learned some English, and every time someone comes, he says, ya welcome, ya welcome. Welcome, but welcome means woe to you. Destruction, right? So welcome. So that's how al-Hajjaj received him. He said to him, you were nobody. You were nobody. You were insignificant. And I gave you status. And I gave you importance. And I brought you closer to me. And you became known because of my favors upon you. Then you revolt against me? He says, قُلْتُ أَصْلَحَ اللَّهُ الْأَمِيرُ كُلُّ مَا قُلْتَهُ حَقٌّ. He says, may Allah rectify the Amir. Everything you said is true. So he depleted the anger of al-Hajjaj. No need to defend himself. He depleted the whole thing. He said, everything you said is true. I confess. Simple as that. So he sort of depleted the argument and he diffused the situation. He diffused the tension in the situation. Then he says, وَلَكِنَّا قَدْ اكْتَحَلْنَا بَعْدَكَ بِالسَّهَرِ وَتَحَلَّسْنَا الْخَوْفِ وَلَمْ نَكُنْ فِي ذَلِكَ أو عَنْ ذَلِكَ بَرَرَةً أَتْقِيَاءَ وَلَا فَجَرَةً أَقْوِيَاءَ وَهَذَا أَوَانُ حَقَنْتَ دَمِي وَاسْتَقْبَلْتَ بِالتَّوْبَةِ. He says, basically, everything you said is true. But after your favors upon us, after the status that you gave us, we made a bad choice. By the way, I'm paraphrasing. So we did not appreciate this, and we made a bad decision. So we ended up with sleepless nights, living in fear. And we didn't get from this. Out of this, we were not righteous. We did not achieve righteousness out of our revolution. And we did not even gain power. So basically we lost in all respects. We lost. But this is the time that you save my life and you forgive my mistakes. So al-Hajjaj, when he heard this, he said, عفوت عنك.
He said, I forgive you, you're free to go. So that shows his presence, his intelligence was actually like impactful. So he was able to save his own life based on this. Let's go just to that side. I was meant to finish a bit early, but I want to show the humor side of his character. So we said he had an issue with thick-blooded people coming with dumb questions. You know, there are people who tell you, for example, how many times should I say to my wife, I love you? Come on, like he says 5 times. It doesn't work. Don't put a number on everything, right? Each couple is different. Each couple is different. Someone says, okay, you know, when I make wudu, when I wash my hands, how long should I keep my hand under the tap? Like, there are things that are just common sense. You don't need to ask about them, right? So some people ask so many specific questions that even make you sick. So Imam al-Sha'bi had a problem with these people. So someone comes to him, and like he heard him saying about, where the Prophet ﷺ talked about تَخْلِيلُ الْلِحْيَةِ. When you wash your face, if you have a beard, and it's thick, so get some water in your hand and put it underneath and rub it. So it goes through your beard. So the man, he was a bit obsessed with this idea. You know, some people like say, did I really wash my hands? Did the water get... So they wash their whole body when making a wudu, just to make sure that actually I made a wudu. They wash their arms, for example, maybe 7 times. Did I make it 3 times? Still, they ask themselves the question, washing their hands sometimes 10 times. Like the guy who went to Imam Abu Hanifa and he said, you know, I jump into the pool and I come out and I don't know if I really made ghusl or not. Can I still pray? He says, no, you don't have to pray. He says, how come? I'm just asking you about like ghusl, is it valid or not? And you're telling me I shouldn't pray at all? He said, yes, because you know, in order for prayer to be obligatory upon you, you have to be a sane human being. You're not, you're insane. Okay? So that's it. So a sane human being, there's no prayer on you. You don't have to pray. So this guy is the same thing. So he came and he says, you know about, you know, rubbing the beard or wiping the beard when I... He says, I'm afraid I won't really get it truly wet. So he says, no problem, just use your fingers to run the water through it. He says, but I'm not convinced. He says, you know what? From the night before, soak it in water. So that was his answer. So for him, he says, you know, just get out of here, man. Leave me alone. So a man سأله رجل هل يجوز للمحرم أن يحك بدنه. You know, when you are in a state of ihram, you're not supposed to trim hair or remove it, right? So some people have this obsessive thinking, like if they feel they want to scratch their heads, how do they do it? Like this, right? And if some, like they feel it's itchy here, they do like this. They don't want any hair to fall. That's not what's meant with ihram. Some people have this kind of waswas. So the man comes to me and he says, if I'm in a state of ihram, can I like scratch my body? He says, yes, you can. What's the big deal? The man says, how much? Or how bad? Or how hard? Obviously, trying to put a number on it. Now, obviously, he gets frustrated with it. He says, well, you keep scratching it until you hit bone. That's how you do. Okay. Al-Sha'bi, you know, at their times they had al-hammam. Al-hammam al-am. Al-hammam basically public baths. You know, like al-hammam al-Turki. You go, it's a massage place, hot bath, something like this. So these were very common. So Imam al-Sha'bi one day goes into this al-hammam. And he founds a man. He comes across a man called Dawood al-Awdi. And at that moment, it seems that the man was like had no sense of shyness, so he didn't have his izar on. He was basically naked. So when Imam al-Sha'bi saw him, he closed his eyes. So the man wants to make fun of al-Sha'bi, but I'm going to say it in Arabic because it sounds much better in Arabic. دخل الشعبي الحمام فرأى داود الأودي بلا مئزر بلا مئزر فأغمض الشعبي عينيه قال داود يا أبا عمر متى عميت قال منذ انهتك الله سترك. Okay, Allah musta'an. It was really funny. This guy was really something. So he sees the man naked and he says, so he closes his eyes. The guy says, oh, when did you become blind? Trying to pick on al-Sha'bi. When did you become blind? He said, when Allah exposed your awrah. But in Arabic it sounds very powerful. Okay. Someone came and asked him, and he said, another guy, thick-blooded guy with this weird question. So he comes to him and he says, Ya Aba Amr, atamradu ar-ruh? He says, you know, the body gets sick, but does the soul get sick as well? So he looked at him and he said, yes, it does get sick. And it gets sick from the thick-blooded people. That's what he said. Naam, tamradu min dhull al-thuqala. So one of his students heard him, and he kept it in mind. So this student, one day, he finds a Shafi'i with two people, and these two people were thick-blooded, known for this kind of questions and this kind of, you know, being dumb. So they were sort of cornering Imam al-Sha'bi and asking him questions. So the student recognized that he was stuck with them. So he says to Imam al-Sha'bi, he says, كَيْفَ هِيَ الرُّوحِ يَا أَبَا عَمْرُ? How is your soul? Is it sick? So Imam al-Sha'bi says, هِيَ فِي النَّزْعِ. So he says, oh, it's dying. My soul is dying now. Anyway, so he had this sense of humor. Another guy comes to Imam al-Shabani and he says, I'm going to read it in Arabic as well first. He says, Mujahid, that's Mujahid al-Mufassir, the great Tabi'i al-Mufassir. He says, I was one day with Imam al-Sha'bi. إني لجالس يوما إذ أقبل جمال معه دنن. دنن is more like a cup or a bowl. حتى وضعه ثم جاءني فقال أنت الشعبي؟ قلت نعم. So Shabi was next to him, but the man mixed them up. So he came to Mujahid and he said, you're a Shabi? He said, yeah. He came to a Shabi when Mujahid was with him. So he said to a Shabi, you're a Shabi? He said, yes. So he said, أخبرني عن إبليس أله زوجة؟ قال الشعبي ذلك عرس ما حضرته. So the guy comes and he finds Mujahid with al-Sha'bi. So he comes to al-Sha'bi and says, you're al-Sha'bi? He says, yes. He says, tell me about Iblis, Satan. Does he have a wife? Imam al-Sha'bi looks at him and he says, that's a wedding I wasn't invited to. Like, I don't know about this. But then he thought later on, he said, actually, I thought about it and I said, he must have a wife. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَفَتَتَّخِذُونَهُ وَذُرِّيَّتَهُ أَوْلِيَاءُ. So do you take shaitan, in Surah Al-Isra, do you take shaitan and his children? So if he has children, he must have a wife. So he was still thinking about it. Anyway, Imam al-Sha'bi, he was still had the sense of humbleness and humility. He said, إِنَّا لَسْنَا بِالْفُقَهَاءُ وَلَكِنَّنَا سَمِعْنَا الْحَدِيثَ فَرَوَيْنَاهُ لَكِنَّ الْفَقِيهَ مَنْ إِذَا عَلِمَ عَمِلَ. He said, we are not the fuqaha. We just heard a hadith and we narrated them. But the faqih, real faqih, is the one that when he learns something, he acts upon it. He lives by it. That's a faqih. One day someone called him and said, Ya Alim. He said, oh, scholar, Ya Alim. He said, إِنَّمَا الْعَالِمُ مَنْ يَخَافُ اللَّهِ. He said, the Alim is the one who fears Allah. So he wasn't comfortable with people calling him Alim or Shaykh. And that's how our Salaf used to be. Didn't like titles. Or don't call me Al-Allama. Or Samahat al-Shaykh. Okay? Or Al-Allama al-Mufti. Or Al-Bahr al-Fahama. All these titles, these are worldly things. So the Salaf didn't like these kind of titles. Rahimahullah ta'ala, he lived till the age 79. So he lived a long life. He lived a long life. He died the year 103 or 104 after Hijrah. 103 or 104 after Hijrah. And he had such a rich life, full of teaching and learning and funny jokes as well that were purposeful and respectful. Rahimahullah ta'ala. So as I said, it's important to know, you know, the important figures in our history and learn from them. By the way, in our days, Shaykh ibn Uthaymeen, although being very studious, he had a sense of humor. It's a tacit sense of humor. Anyone who listened to the classes of Shaykh ibn Uthaymeen carefully, you would actually catch this in him. You would catch this in him, rahmatullah alayh. So I remember one day someone asked him and he said, you know, I married a wife And obviously because the Sheikh was talking about, you know, before a marriage, any kind of deficiency in the husband or the wife should be declared. Should be declared. So the guy heard this and he came and asked the Sheikh, he said, you know, I married a wife and they didn't tell me about anything. But later on after marriage, I realized there were some teeth missing in her mouth. The Sheikh said, does she bite you? He said, no. He said, keep her. Okay. So the Sheikh had this kind of sense of humor as well. Okay. And it's good. It actually helps people relate. And this is why Sheikh Ibn Uthaymeen was accessible, rahimahullah. And Allah like made him so accepted and loved by so many people. And this is why Allah benefited a lot of people through his classes, his recorded classes, and his books, and his fatawa, rahimahullah ta'ala. So this is basically about Al-Imam al-Sha'bi. As I said, next week inshaAllah the halaqa will be again after Isha. Keep it after Isha. When the time changes, so in 2 weeks from now, it will be after Maghrib. In 2 weeks from now, it will be after Maghrib, because Maghrib most likely will be 7:30. So we're probably starting around maybe 7:45 or 7:50, which is a good time to start the halaqa. Jazakumullah khairan. Barakallahu feekum. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Muhammad wa alayhi wa sahbihi wa sallam. I apologize, I won't take any personal questions because I need to rush. I'm behind already. Zakat. Barakallahu feekum.